Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are tackling a topic today that is, frankly, a little vertiginous.
Yeah, that's a good word for it.
Right, because we're looking at the 17th century, which usually brings to mind, you know, powdered wigs and rigid social codes. But intellectually, it was an absolute battlefield.
Oh, totally. It was the century where the floor basically dropped out of the Western worldview. You had the rise of mechanistic science think Galileo, Newton, Hobbes, and they're painting this picture of a universe that was basically a giant clock, just matter in motion, dead stuff hitting other dead stuff.
Which is a massive problem if you're trying to hold on to the idea of a soul or God or even free will, because if the universe is just billiard balls knocking into each other, there's no room for, like, spirit. And this is exactly where our protagonist comes in, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz.
Yes.
He's looking at this huge divide materialism on one side, traditional Christian theology on the other, and he decides he's going to fix it. He's going to broker a peace treaty.
But he's not just trying to patch holes. I mean, he's trying to build a completely new metaphysical architecture from the ground up.
Based on the lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes that we're diving into today, Leibniz is arguably the most ambitious synthesizer in the history of philosophy. He looks at someone like Spinoza, who basically said, everything is God, a sort of pantheist view. And Leibniz rejects that completely because it destroys individuality.
Right. If everything is God, then you and I don't really exist as individuals.
Exactly. But then he looks at the materialists who say everything is atoms, and he rejects that too, because atoms are just dead matter. He wants a system where the world is mechanical, sure, but also spiritual, determined, but also free.
And his solution to this impossible puzzle is the monad.
A monad.
Yeah. And what struck me immediately in the source material is that Leibniz isn't just making things up for fun. He actually backs himself into a corner using pure logic. He arrives at the monad because he thinks it's literally the only logical way reality can exist.
So let's get into it. What on earth is a monad? Because it's not an atom, right? Not a little hard pellet of stuff.
No, not at all. This isn't mystical speculation. It's rigorous logic. Leibniz starts with a simple question. What is substance? What is the very basic building block of reality?
Okay.
The materialists of his day, the atomists, said it was physical atoms. Little tiny chunks of matter.
But Leibniz completely destroys that idea with a simple observation about extension, doesn't he?
He does. He argues that anything extended, meaning anything that takes up space, has size, has shape, is by definition a composite. It's made of parts.
Because you can always imagine cutting it in half.
Precisely. Even if it's really, really small, if it has a left side and a right side, you can conceptually divide it. And if you could divide it, it's not a basic building block. It's an aggregate.
So if you keep dividing matter, you never actually hit
a hard bottom.
Right. You just get smaller and smaller piles of stuff.
And Leibniz says that a true substance, the actual foundational unit of reality, must be simple. It cannot have parts. And if it has no parts, it cannot have extension. It can't have size.
So it cannot be physical in the way we think of physics.
Exactly. So the building blocks of the universe aren't material things at all. They are metaphysical points of force.
That is a massive pivot. He's turning physics into metaphysics. So a monad isn't a speck of dust. It's a unit of energy.
Think of it as a center of psychic force or vital energy. It's unextended, indivisible. And because it has no parts, it can't be destroyed by natural means. You can't smash it because there's nothing to break apart. It is a fundamental unit of existence that is actually much more like a mind or a soul than a rock.
Which brings us to arguably the most famous and definitely the most claustrophobic description in all of philosophy. Leibniz says these monads are windowless.
Yes. The monads have no windows through which anything could come in or go out.
This is where people usually get stuck. I mean, I got stuck here.
It's totally baffling at first.
Yeah.
But again, follow his logic. If a monad is a simple substance with no parts, how could it possibly interact with another monad? Interaction implies a transfer, right? I give you energy, you receive it. Parts of me affect parts of you. But monads have no parts, so they are hermetically sealed units of being.
So causal interaction, like the idea that I push a coffee cup and the cup moves because I physically touched it, is an illusion.
In the strictest metaphysical sense, yes. Leibniz is saying that one substance absolutely cannot causally influence another substance. They are completely isolated from one another.
Which seems to lead us into a very lonely universe. I mean, if my soul is a monad, I'm basically locked in a windowless room. I can't see out. Nothing can get in. So how do I have any experience at all? How do we even know there's a world out there?
Well, because even though the room is windowless, it's furnished. and the furniture is perception.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah. And this is where Leibniz introduces the great chain of being, or what he calls the principle of continuity. He views reality as a sliding scale of monads. They range from the very bottom to the very top. And they aren't distinguished by what they are, they are all monads, but by the clarity of their perception.
Right. Dr. Holmes made a really important distinction here in the lecture between perception and apperception. And I think this is crucial because otherwise we end up thinking that, like, gravel is conscious.
Exactly. Yeah. We have to be careful with words here. Perception, for Leibniz, is just an internal state that represents external things. It doesn't imply consciousness. A bare monad, like the kind that makes up a rock or a piece of wood, has perception. It registers its place in the universe, but it's in a state of stupor.
Like a deep swoon.
Yes, a swoon. Hmm? It has a distinct internal state, but it isn't awake to it.
It's like a subconscious hum.
That's a good analogy. Then you move up the ladder to animals. They have sensation and memory. A dog remembers its owner. It feels physical pain, but it doesn't reflect on itself.
And then us.
We are spirit monads. We have apperception. We don't just perceive. We are actually aware that we are perceiving. We have self-consciousness, reason, the ability to say, I.
And at the very top of this hierarchy, presumably, is God.
The supreme monad. Perfect apperception. God perceives everything, everywhere, with infinite clarity, all at once. There are no gaps in nature for Leibniz. Every slot is filled, from the lowest bare monad to the highest.
Okay, so we have this hierarchy of clarity, but I want to go back to the windowless part, because this is wild. If I have apperception, if I'm totally aware of this conversation happening right now, but I have no windows, where is this conversation coming from?
Right.
It feels like I'm hearing you speak, but Leibniz says I can't receive input from the outside.
This is the radical consequence of his system. If you have no windows, then your experience isn't coming from the outside. It's bubbling up from the inside. Leibniz argues for innate ideas in the strongest possible sense. You aren't a blank slate. You're not a tabula rasa like Locke or Aristotle thought.
You're pre-programmed.
Yes. You are more like a seed that already contains the entire blueprint of the full-grown tree within it.
So, to be clear, my experience of hearing your voice right now is actually just my own internal programming unfolding.
Yes. Your mind is generating these perceptions from its own depths. You are playing out a script that was written entirely into your nature.
But that creates a massive problem. If I'm running my script in my windowless room, and you're running your script in your windowless room, and we literally cannot communicate, why does it match up? Why, when I ask a question, do you answer it? Why aren't we just hallucinating completely different realities right now?
This is what philosophers call the problem of interaction, and it leads to what I think is Leibniz's most dazzling concept.
Yeah.
Pre-established harmony.
Ah, the synchronized clocks.
The synchronized clocks. It's a classic analogy. Imagine two absolutely perfect clocks. They always tell the exact same time. How? Well, not because clock A pushes the gears of clock B, and not because someone is standing there constantly adjusting them. It's because the clockmaker God built them so perfectly from the start that they remain in sync forever without ever touching.
So apply that to you and me.
God, in his infinite intellect, surveyed all possible worlds before creating this one. And he chose the exact world where your script and my script harmonize perfectly. When your internal drive, your appetition, as Leibniz calls it, prompts you to ask a question, my internal drive is pre-programmed to provide the answer at that exact millisecond.
That is just breathtakingly complex,
right,
because
now.
It implies that every single monad in the universe is choreographed with every other monad.
It does. It's a perfectly synchronized masterpiece. And this connects to the idea of mirroring. Because of this insane harmony, Leibniz says that every single monad actually mirrors the entire universe from its own specific perspective.
I loved the jigsaw puzzle analogy from the source material here. Every piece is unique.
Right. The identity of indiscernibles. No two things are truly identical.
Exactly. But even though they are totally unique, the shape of one piece implies the shape of the whole puzzle because it has to fit perfectly into its specific slot.
Yes. If you could see with perfect clarity into the depths of a single monad, even just a tiny bare monad in a speck of dust, you could read the entire history and future of the universe.
Hmm.
Because its internal state is a reflection of everything else that exists. We literally carry the cosmos inside us.
It totally flips the modern view on its head. We usually think we are these tiny little things inside a massive universe. Leibniz thinks we are massive universes, thinking we are tiny little things.
That's a profound way to look at it.
But I have to ask about the physical world. If everything is just these windowless spiritual points of force, why do I have a body? Why do things look and feel solid?
Well, Leibniz doesn't deny the physical world. He just redefines what it is. He treats the body as a composite. It's a colony. Your body is just a swarm of millions of bare monads, blood monads, skin monads, bone monads, that are temporarily organized under the dominance of your soul monad.
Like a queen bee in the hive.
That's a brilliant comparison. Your soul is the dominant monad that unifies the whole swarm.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the trick. The swarm itself acts according to mechanical laws. The body is a machine. It follows the laws of physics, size, shape, and motion. But the soul follows the laws of appetition, or desire, teleological laws.
Teleological meaning purpose-driven.
Right. And because of pre-established harmony, the mechanical body and the purposeful soul run on parallel tracks. They never intersect, but they always align. When your soul desires to raise an arm, the mechanical swarm of your arm happens to move upward, based purely on physical laws at that exact same moment.
So he actually preserves science and the soul by keeping them on completely separate but synchronized tracks.
Exactly. It allows him to say to the physicist, "You are right, the body is a machine." And to the theologian, "You are right, the soul is independent and spiritual." It's genius.
Speaking of bodies and souls, we have to talk about the biology side of this, because Dr. Holmes brought up a concept called animalculism, which honestly sounds like a 17th century insult.
It really does. But it's actually a fascinating theory of generation, a kind of vitalism that Leibniz adopted.
How does it fit into the windowless monads?
Well, it fits perfectly. Think about it. If monads are indestructible because they have no parts, then they can't be created or destroyed by natural means. They can only be created by God or annihilated by God. So the question is, where do babies come from?
Right. They can't just magically pop into existence out of nowhere, conception.
No, because that would require a new miracle, a brand new creation every single time.
Yeah.
And Leibniz rejects that. So he adopts the biological view of his day, which was that the offspring, both body and soul, is already preformed. It exists fully formed, but in miniature, within the seed, the sperm of the father.
The homunculus.
Essentially, yes. He genuinely believes that since the beginning of the world, all the future generations of humans were present in Adam, just waiting to unfold. Conception isn't a new beginning. It's a transformation.
Dr. Holmes compared it to a caterpillar becoming a butterfly.
Yes. Leibniz calls it elevation. The animalcule in the seed is just a lower-level sensing organism. But at conception, God elects or elevates that specific monad to the status of a rational spirit.
Mm.
It wakes up, it gets apperception.
And what about death?
Death is just the reverse process. The swarm of bare monads disperses, and the dominant monad folds back in on itself. It shrinks down and goes back to a state of stupor or sleep, but it is never, ever destroyed.
It's a very tidy system when you look at it. There's absolutely no waste. Energy is completely conserved. Speaking of energy, where did all these monads come from originally if they aren't eternal? How did God make them?
Oh, this is a great point. Leibniz rejects deism, the idea that God created the world like a clockmaker, wound it up, and then walked away. He uses a very specific word, fulguration. Yes. Dr. Holmes defined it in the lecture as being like striking a match. God is continuously generating the energy of the universe. He doesn't just create existence. He sustains it moment by moment through these continuous flashes of divine energy.
Incredible. But we have to address the massive elephant in this windowless room.
Free will.
Always the sticking point, right? If I am running a pre-written script, and if God specifically chose this exact possible world because it's the one where my script harmonizes with yours, then my choice to speak to you right now was determined before the dawn of time. How is that freedom?
Leibniz knew this was his biggest vulnerability. People accused him of being a pure determinist, just like Spinoza. He tries to solve it by distinguishing between two different types of truth. He separates truths of reason from truths of fact.
Walk us through that distinction.
Okay, a truth of reason is something based on pure logic. Like, a triangle has three sides. It is logically necessary. Its opposite is a literal contradiction. Even God cannot make a four-sided triangle. It's based on the law of non-contradiction.
Okay, that makes sense.
But a truth of fact is different. Take the statement, Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon. It is not logically necessary that Caesar crossed that river. He could have stayed in Gaul, and it wouldn't have created a mathematical contradiction in the universe. It's what we call a contingent truth. It could have been otherwise.
But didn't God know he would cross it? God chose the world where he crosses it?
God knew. And this is the extreme subtlety of Leibniz's argument. He says that while it was certain Caesar would cross the Rubicon, it wasn't compelled by any external force. Caesar crossed the river because it was in Caesar's nature to cross it. It was based on the law of sufficient reason. There was a reason for everything.
So he was driven by his own appetition.
Yes, his own internal desire and reasoning. So freedom, for Leibniz, isn't I could have done absolutely anything randomly. It's I did what flowed naturally from my own character without external coercion.
Ah, it's teleological freedom.
Exactly. You are free because your actions are determined by your own purposes and internal states. You aren't just being kicked around by external physical forces like a billiard ball. In fact, because you are windowless, literally everything you do comes from inside you. So you are, in a weird way, the most autonomous being possible.
I see the argument. It's freedom from external constraint, even if it's not freedom from internal necessity. You are playing out your script, but it is your script.
Right. And Leibniz would argue, what other kind of freedom would you even want? Do you want to act completely randomly for no reason, or do you want to act according to who you fundamentally are?
Because if you act without a reason, it's not really your choice anyway. It's just random noise.
Precisely. Your choices are rooted in your monadic state.
We've covered a huge amount of ground here. We've gone from the microscopic, indivisible units of substance to the cosmic architecture of God's pre-established harmony. And I think the reason Leibniz is still so captivating for us today, even if we don't buy the 17th century biology, is the sheer optimism of his system.
It is relentlessly optimistic. I mean, he famously argues that this is the best of all possible worlds, not because it has no pain or suffering, obviously it does, but because God chose the world that maximizes the variety and richness of existence while maintaining the simplest, most elegant laws.
It's a universe that is just completely saturated with meaning.
And I think that's the real takeaway for us. In the mechanistic view, the universe is mostly empty space and dead, pointless matter. But in Leibniz's view, every single point of reality is alive with energy. Every point is a unique perspective. Every point is a mirror of the infinite. It dignifies the individual in a way modern science often doesn't. You aren't just a biological machine. You are a purposeful microcosm.
It really challenges the isolation we sometimes feel. We started out by saying the monad is lonely, windowless, sealed off in a room. But if Leibniz is right, that isolation is just an illusion. We are actually more intimately connected to the universe than in any other philosophical system because we literally carry the whole thing inside of us.
We are solitary yet universal. That's a beautiful paradox.
I want to leave everyone listening with a provocative thought based on this. We live in an age of algorithms, right? We constantly worry about echo chambers. We worry that our news feeds and social media are just showing us what we already want to see.
Which is a very Leibnizian fear if you think about it.
Exactly. If Leibniz is right, we are the ultimate echo chamber. Because we are windowless, we never truly encounter the other. We only ever encounter our own internal representation of them bubbling up from our innate programming. So the next time you feel a deep, profound connection with someone, or you feel like you truly learned something new today, ask yourself, is this actually a bridge being built between two minds? Or is it just a moment of exquisite, pre-established harmony where your internal clock simply chimed at the exact same millisecond as theirs?
And honestly,
yeah,
does it even matter which one it is, as long as the music plays?
That is the question. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you in the next possible world.